Hello and welcome to the Department of Agricultural Economics podcast. This is Jessica and I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Ken Foster. How are you, Ken?
I'm doing well, Jessica. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, although it's a bit dreary outside.
Well, spring is here. I'm sorry. We finally had some warm weather and a little shower every now and then just makes things grow and beautifies the world. But
spoken like a true farmer.
Like a true farmer. But, you know, here's the thing. From the point of view of a true Hoosier, we know that a long, cold winter just makes us appreciate spring that much more when it finally arrives.
Right, that's the spirit.
This is how we survive it.
So joining us today is Dr. Thomas Nielsen, who is an alumni of the Department of Ag Econ, originally from Sweden, but now he lives in Canada. And he is an expert on impact analysis, and we're going to have a bit of a discussion with him here today. How are you? Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm fine, thanks. And I do enjoy the weather here. It's you're about 3 weeks ahead of us from Edmonton, where I live. So, yeah, we enjoy it.
It's always good to go south in the wintertime. Yeah. You know what else Thomas is? He's the father of my godson.
Oh.
So Thomas is actually here with his son, Lorenz.
Hello, Lorenz.
Hi.
We have Lorenz in our studio today. Yes. We have a guest. How old are you?
Seven.
All right. Do we have a future agricultural economist on our hands?
Do you like
maybe
charts
not and
stuff?
Yes. For those of you who can't see, that was a definitive yes. That's great.
Lorenz's mother is also a graduate of Purdue. She's a graduate of the PhD program in economics.
Right.
So he has a good pedigree.
Yeah, indeed. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do regarding impact analysis?
So I've been with the government for about 7 years. I started working, most of our work centered around economic development and assessing the impact of various scenarios on economic development potential in the province. As time went on, however, we quickly realized that we were didn't have a very strong toolbox to assist us, and it did a disservice on a couple of different ways. So first of all, we found that we spent a lot of time not being able to test some of the hypotheses we had about the various proposals that came through. Secondly, we find it also sometimes challenging to deal with stakeholders because, you know, simply we didn't have a tool, so it was hard to develop sort of a common language or theorem. We didn't quite know what to ask for, and it was also hard for them to give us help. More importantly, it was difficult in communicating the results and sort of why it mattered, what we were saying had sort of any leg to stand upon. So over the past couple of years, we have purchased and utilized a couple of different impact models. One was developed by a boutique firm in Ontario, and another one that we currently hold a license to is developed by an organization or a for-profit company in Amherst, Massachusetts, called the REMI model.
So can you explain to those who might be listening who may not actually really understand what an impact model is? As though you were explaining it to Lorenz, could you explain what that means?
So in many cases, what happens is that we're either being asked or we anticipate being asked by elected officials or senior executives about. Take for example the relatively recent drop in oil prices. So how does that affect the economy? What are some of the main challenges, the channels that the economy will be affected in terms of employment and creation of employment by industry? What are some of the regional impacts? What are some of the impacts on these supply chain sectors that they call? Traditional economic impact analysis concerns with measuring sort of the direct economic impacts, direct effects, the indirect effects, and the induced effects. And the models we have allow us to measure the direct effects somewhat consistently, but then when it comes to the indirect and the induced impacts, because we have different suite of models, they all make slightly different assumptions about how the economy works. It allows us to get a range or a sensitivity, if you so will. So to give an example, Alberta is a relatively energy-intensive province. We produce and export a relatively large amount of the raw products, the bitumen, in a non-upgraded form. So then the question on a lot of people's mind is that, is there a potential to build some kind of manufacturing facility that would add additional value to the resource and then export it? So what would that impact look like, and in terms of should there be any state support, are we competing for the same type of workers in the upstream industries as in these manufacturing locations?
You used a term that bitumen, that those of us south of the border might not be familiar with. Thomas,
yeah.
Want to define that for us?
Yeah, so in the provinces of British Columbia and Alberta are sitting on a geological formation. It's called the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin, which contains a lot of coal, a lot of natural gas, a lot of conventional oil, and the oil sands. And the oil sands can be extracted either through surface mining, so you basically take away the topsoil and you excavate it out down to about 50 meters below the surface. Most of the oil sands, however, sits deeply underground, a couple of hundred meters under the ground level, and it has to be extracted up. And then when it comes up from the ground, it's called bitumen. So it's actually oil products or petroleum products that is tied up to sand. In most of that product is exported in its raw form. So it's blended because it's not very viscous, so you can't pipe it, put it in a pipeline. So you have to blend it with a diluent. It's called Dilbit. And you put it in the pipelines and you ship it to a refinery. And a relatively large portion of what is extracted from Alberta and not sent to an upgrader in Canada is actually sent to a refinery here in the Midwest, in Whiting.
Whiting, Indiana?
Yes.
So you're a perfect example of somebody who got their PhD here, and rather than going into academia, you took it and you used it and applied it to a real-world situation where you're addressing these problems that actually directly impact your community. Did you find it difficult to transition from the academic world into this very applied world?
So I did work for about 3.5 years at the University of Alberta, and I made the transition then. And there were, it was a fairly big step. However, fortunately, I did have a relatively large support group that were willing to provide assistance in terms of mentoring, in terms of, everything as it relates to the days when how you spend your work time. I found that I do spend about 50% to 70% of my time spent in meetings.
Dreaded meetings!
Yeah.
Although Ken spends a lot of his as the head of the department. Ken, how do you feel about meetings?
Not usually very happy. I like meetings with a very crisp agenda.
So I'm not sure. It's a very different way of working and of collaborating. So I think to me that was a very relatively big change. In terms of writing, we talked about that a little bit earlier before your podcast started. I think as academics and as former academics, we learn to communicate very well to a very specialized audience, and it's about learning to adopt and adjust the message so that you can communicate to other stakeholders that are not necessarily having a graduate degree in your field or are not used to reading papers and so forth. So needless to say, I did get a fair bit of pushback on my first couple of briefings I put through the system. They're like, you don't need to cite the references. You use more of a layman language here and so forth. And I had to strip out the equations and so forth from my first couple of briefings. But yeah.
Learning curve. There was a learning curve.
It was indeed a steep one, but it was good support around. I worked in a very good unit where they were very good in setting very clear expectations for that, so I could actually go and get help. Also in the environment we were working in, we were allowed to take risks and we were allowed to fail. So we were also allowed to sort of learn from that. It was pointed out to us saying, you know, this time it went well and this time it didn't go so well.
So, Thomas, were the things about the training here at Purdue that prepared you particularly well to succeed in this environment?
Yeah, I think it's about the thinking skills and the communication skills that you get. One thing that we were talking about here the past couple of days was about incentives, right? So learning what... I think it's something that you traditionally would not pick up in a non-economic type of program. In terms of understanding why people behave the way they do behave, economics has can provide some remarkable insights into human behavior, and they can explain to you why decisions are being made, even at the corporate level, although you think at the outset that this, you know, this doesn't make sense, this seems to be very erratic. People are making decisions in a way that also seems to be inconsistent with how you think about, you would believe they would think about the world, but that boils down to the ex ante and the ex post outcomes that you're seeing. You actually don't know for sure what went into, what was all the information that went into the person's mind or into the discussion when they were making decisions. We see the outcome of that.
But, and I think it's fair to say that a lot of times we don't even know what factors go into why we make decisions.
I tend to find, going back to the notion around the willingness to take risk and learn from that, if you're extremely risk averse, you will make decisions in certain ways that will probably in the long run not be in the best interest of the organization. So,
well, I think we're discovering in some of the literature and psychology that's crossing over, and I guess maybe interdisciplinary with economics, that we have the capacity to be very selective about what information we actually process and how we weight different information, and that, you know, our unintentional biases or our unintentional risk averse aspects of our behavior filter out some information to our sometimes detriment.
Yep.
And we often, in that vein, we often look back on decisions we've made and we apply rationale when there may not have been rationale in that moment, like any rational reason in that moment. Oh, all the psychology that has to go into your job. So complicated.
Well, this is the beautiful thing about economics, right? The study of human behavior, and human behavior is probably the most complex thing in all of the universe.
Yes.
And that's what makes studying economics exciting, and studying applied economics at Purdue, I think, is a great pursuit.
So one of the reasons why I wanted to go when I applied to go to the PhD program at Purdue is that I had a previous exposure to the department as an undergraduate student, and it was very, very positive. Struck me it was a relatively large department, extremely solid in its reputation, both from the public sector and from the industry itself, and also by other academics. So it sounded like this was a department that was able to provide, being a potential where you could access staff that could provide perspective to the research that you're doing, that gives you both a balance or a good flavor when it comes to how do you develop a research proposal that's appealing to industry, that's appealing to the public public sector or the government, and that also has some academic potential to actually make a significant contribution to the field. And there are few departments, in my humble opinion, that actually provide students with this opportunity coming to tap into this resource. It's an open door policy. The networking opportunities with other graduate students was very great. We had the possibility to interact with people from essentially all over the world who came to Purdue with essentially one a couple of objectives in their mind: to become better people, to learn how to master the topic they were studying, and many of them also had the ambition to go back to their respective region and make a significant contribution. And I'm still in touch with my colleagues at the PhD program, and I mean, they're all over the United States, all over the world, in Africa, in Europe.
In fact, you're in particularly close contact with one of your former fellow graduate student colleagues, right?
Yes, and I'm wondering which one the... Yes.
I think I'm talking about your wife.
That's right. Yes, okay. I saw the glimmer there of Ken's eye. I was thinking, what do you think? Yes,
obviously. One of my all-time Purdue agricultural economics graduate moments was when you were explaining to me one of your early interactions with Valentina, who is now your wife, and she, in fact, is from Italy, and you were trying to impress her with your command of the Italian language.
That's right.
You want to impart that story for the rest of us?
So that's right. We took the same courses the first couple of years, and I do remember, as it was yesterday, the first day we had our class together. It was down on the ground floor in Cranach Building, and I believe it was for Dr. Norbcek, and the bell rang, or it was time to start the class, and Dr. Norbcek said, well, you have to reserve this desk for someone who's going to show up a bit later. And after a few minutes, was a knock on the door, and Valentina stepped in, and all the boys were looking at this extremely good-looking Italian lady. And so I immediately started calling her Principessa. And then I had learned some Italian here when I was an undergrad at Purdue. So, you know, I wanted to say, I love you, amore, and I'm... You know, of course, with my way of learning languages, I thought, you know, you could say amorti or morti. So that went on for a couple of years. And one day, when I called out morti principessa in the hallway, she stopped and she turned around and she said, Thomas, for 2 years now you said you want to kill me. Why do you want to do that? And, well... We became very good friends and started dating, and yeah.
And the rest is history. In fact, we have proof in the form of the 7-year-old right here.
That's right. So. We have a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old, and they're all both very, very happy. So, yeah.
It's really great that you were able to come in and join us and that you had this time to talk to us. It's been really nice. And again, this is Dr. Thomas Nielsen. Who currently is working in Canada for the Canadian government.
Thanks very much for being with us, Thomas.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you. I am Thomas Nielsen, a graduate of Purdue Agricultural Economics, and currently I'm a Director of Economic Modeling and Research with the Ministry of Innovation and Advanced Education with the Government of Alberta in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. You have been listening to our Purdue Agricultural Economics podcast. Please visit the department's website at www.agecon.purdue.edu and like us on Facebook.